Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 32, The Rorschach Test.
The purpose of Shortbox Showcase is to talk about topics in comics that fall outside of our respective solo shows.
But first, a little feedback. Let's start with shoutouts to our two most recent iTunes feedbackers. Chris, from the shows Mythmaking ETC and the Geek Brunch Retrocast, said nice things about our solo shows and described this one like a team-up of superheroes. They come together to form the Shortbox Showcase. What's not to like?
Wonder Twin powers activate! Shape of insightful criticism!
Form of water!
All right, then.
That was never really one of the strengths of the Wonder Twins, I thought.
No.
Well, thank you, Chris.
The enigmatic J3KC said that our rapport was wonderful and summed up the network as cheap comics, check, old comics, check, themed episodes, check. That pretty much does sum it up, doesn't it?
Right to the point. Well, thank you for the feedback. 10 more stars.
Woohoo!
Actually, it was 15 more stars because one person left us a rating without a review.
You know what? We will take that.
Gladly. We also wanted to mention one of our newest listeners and feedbackers, the Puzzler 6.
I don't think that's his real name.
We could ask his brothers and sisters, Puzzlers 1 through 5.
Hmm.
That's what they call a callback in the broadcast business. Puzzler sent in a list of anticipated convergence and post-convergence books, but I wanted to put off that email for a while as we're planning a convergence recap. Mm-hmm. Episode down the road, so we'll go into the details of the email then, but I did want to acknowledge and thank him for that email.
Also, our friend Noel from Masters of Carpentry wrote in about the Superman and Batman episode we did with Michael Bradley. Superman and Batman absolutely are the Mount Rushmore of superheroes, though the one I'll be taking pictures of during that tourist stop is Spider-Man, swinging by and webbing mustaches on the two of them.
You see, J. Jonah Jameson may have been right.
Could be a menace.
Not showing proper respect.
Noel's email continues. Seriously, I've never found myself getting deep into either one. I've just never found either hugely interesting. They're absolutely the foundations upon which all of this started, but I guess I've just been more interested in the ornamental pillars and archways that have risen up since.
See, to me, that was an interesting point. I was thinking, is it reasonable to appreciate what has come from an original work, but not respect or appreciate or like the original work? Is that okay?
I think that was part of my point that mm-hmm. I was trying to bring in my experience of Superman, because I'm not really that big of a Superman fan, but I love him. Like, it's like
right.
those
no,
two
I gotcha.
Things are
right.
distinct. That I love what Superman represents, but I would not call myself a passionate fan. I was in as big of a froth as anybody else about the recent costume changes, but that's not going to make me stop buying the book because I'm not buying the book. You know what I'm saying?
But that does bring up just a broader idea of what do we do with the Golden Age?
Yeah.
In terms of, do we have to be fans of it? Do we have to respect it? Do we have to appreciate it?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have to love it? That's a hard sell.
Yeah.
I think appreciating is a reasonable response, a reasonable request to make for a comics fan
yeah.
to at least appreciate what went on. If you like it, that's fine. If you don't like it, that's fine. But at least to acknowledge the comics didn't start with FF1 or with Man of Steel 1 or with wherever they started back in the late 30s, and acknowledge that history.
Yeah. Or for people of my vintage, when, you know, Alan Moore showed up.
Yeah, there you go.
Because you go. I have talked to some people who will refuse to read anything pre-Moore. And I was like, wow, you are missing out on some good stuff. Then again, that's just my cross to bear
yeah.
in general. Really, guys, there were good stories before whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow. There's actual good stories.
I mean, it's like trying to talk to people who love modern movies.
Mm-hmm.
That there's value that you can get from black and white movies, or even from movies from the 50s and 60s and 70s.
That's another hard sell. I've been trying to convince some of my friends to have a silent movie marathon with me. Mostly, I just really want to watch The Artist.
We also got a catch-up email from new listener Jason Marquinette from a new comics and beer YouTube channel. called Heroes and Hops. He's actually pretty new to podcasts in general and said that he even appreciates our shout-outs to other shows. That's the beauty of your podcasts. They add comics and podcasts and blogs to my long list of things to look into.
I mean, that's how we got started in podcasting. Not just doing it, but listening to stuff is, oh, there's this interesting show because I want to know about this particular TV show or comic or whatever. I'll start listening to this podcast. Oh, they have friends who do other shows that sound vaguely interesting.
They talk about a show that they just guested on, or they have a guest on their show, and that person sounds interesting, so you track them down.
Next thing you know, you're sending in all of them emails, and then you're buying a headset and convincing me to do a podcast with you. I mean, what?
I don't get it. I'm pretty sure it's Jack and Eddie's fault.
It usually is.
Bailey was involved as well.
Again, he usually is.
Jason said that he loves Identity Crisis. Hey, someone on our side. Which came out right when he was getting back into comics, and it made him a Green Arrow fan. He said that he couldn't find his copies of the individual issues, so he knows he's going to eventually buy the trade. He also said he added the White Tiger trade to his to-buy list. He also had a suggestion on Under Red Comics, our episode 22, and this is one that I've heard good things about. It's an indie book, I think it's from Oni Press, called The Sixth Gun, written by Cullen Bunn. Sort of a weird western. My guess is if you like Jonah Hex, you'll probably like Sixth Gun. The bad news, the series is ending at issue 50. The good news, the series is collected in trade, and there are two miniseries.
Well, that's still 18 issues longer than Demon Knights, so...
Still kind of bitter about that, aren't you?
I'm not getting over this anytime soon. I have a lot of crosses to bear.
Well,
but that does sound very interesting, and I do need some more weird western in my life.
I have heard good things about The Sixth Gun. I know at one point it was one of the, I don't know, zillion properties that had been optioned for television. They're kicking it around for TV. I think that may have been the context that I heard someone talk about it as the comics themselves being really strong as well. So thanks, Jason, for writing in. We appreciate that.
We also got some feedback on our Valentine's Day episode from that one guy who does the one show and is married to Cindy Franklin. Oh, right. Chris.
That's what they're calling him these days. Chris.
Professor and Emily. Great episode. Although when I saw the image for this, I silently cursed. I'd started to use that Superman The Wedding album spread as an image for our latest Supermates show. But hey, great minds think alike.
Nice self-promotion there, Chris. Sliding it into the content of the email. This man's a professional.
Nice.
Impressive.
One more thing about Ollie and Dinah that a lot of folks forget. They were originally a May-December romance. Dinah came from the Golden Age. She was a widow and quickly fell for this charming and apparently younger man. This is obviously the reason that Jerry Conway and Roy Thomas came up with the It's Her Daughter bit in that crazy JLA-JSA crossover, which just, FYI, ew.
Yes, that does not make it better.
No, so much not better. So they really have done everything with that couple. Yes, they have. Let's just say this. Comics are weird and occasionally gross.
And the people who read comic books, kind of weird.
Occasionally
gross. Sometimes gross.
I sense the joke, but I can't see the lie. Superman and Lois belong together. Period. Having watched all 10 seasons of Smallville, you poor soul, I do believe that version of Klana, Clark and Lana, is fairly maligned. That's not a fault of either actor, but the writing staff who really made Lana an unlikable nuisance on the show. I was a fan of the Batman-Wonder Woman relationship on JLJLU.
See, a little more affirmation.
But that was partly because those are mine and Cindy's two favorite comic book characters, so it was a nice bit for us in particular. I really think the Batman-Wonder Woman thing, it really is the shipping. It's not that as a couple they make sense and would be good and wonderful for each other. It's, I like this character. I like this character. Now kiss! And that's fine. Emily has a great point about Reed becoming a total loser after the 1960s. She nailed it. Victor Rue might honestly have been a better choice. There you go. Affirmation.
Well, thank you, Chris, and tell Cindy we said hello. We also heard from Hugo Rivera. Greetings, Professor and Ms. Emily. Just some feedback on your fine podcasts. I appreciate all the hard work you guys do and look forward to your takes on the different topics. And those quarter bin reviews, of course. Of course. Emily, I can't believe you don't like Batman the Brave and the Bold. It's actually a good show with a lot of heart. You might enjoy it. The same goes for Arrow. And you haven't seen Man of Steel? The shame. Anyway, rant over. Keep up the good work, and I'll be listening. Sincerely, Hugo.
Quick question. Have I done my rant about why I actually hate Brave and the Bold? It's not the content. It's that we couldn't get the Super Best Friends Forever ongoing show because they had to be the minisodes, and this got full 25-minute episodes. Have I made that rant?
No. Well, I mean, just now.
Because that's the actual issue. The issue isn't that I think it's a terrible show. It's just not something I'm personally interested in. And the fact that it took a TV slot away from what could have been a rotating open slot for all of those awesome 3-minute minisodes that they released online.
Like Sword of the Atom and Super Best Friends Forever. In our world, those actually could have been the shows in that spot.
Exactly. So the fact that they essentially burned a slot on what's really just pretty decent slapstick comedy, when you could have released that as free online minisodes. But no, we have to give the slot to Batman because he's Batman.
That is true.
Anyway, rant over.
Now, the funny thing is, Hugo was worried about his first email taking you to the woodshed.
Oh.
Ripping you apart. So he wrote back in a few hours later. Greetings, Professor and Emily. Sorry about my ranting in the other email. Also, I forgot some stuff.
That happens.
Yeah, that happens when you don't write things down and just rely on your memory. Oh, Hugo, tell me about it. And in 30 years, Emily, tell me about it.
You'll have to,
because I will have forgotten. Anyway, Hugo talks about the Shippers episode. I'm mostly a DC reader, so Marvel is a blind spot for me. I also had a laugh at the fact that anybody is better for Sue than Reed.
Seriously.
This is the official position of the Relatively Geeky Network.
Worst person.
Didn't know he was so detached. I guess genius only takes you so far. Maybe Doom and Sue really should be together. Submit your pitch to Joe Quesada. If he approved one more day, I don't see a problem with this idea. And I love your concept for the Justice League Identity Crisis TV show crossover. Even if I don't like that fate for Felicity. But I know that sacrifices must be made. Keep up the good work, and I'll keep listening. Hugo. Well, thank you, Hugo, for both of the emails, and feel free to rant away.
I can take it.
And I think she ranted back harder, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we also wanted to talk about our most recent candidate, and I would say leading candidate, for 2015 Listener of the Year, Canada's Rob Lance.
He sent us this email. Alan and Emily, longtime listener, first-time caller. Just wanted to drop you both a message to say thank you. Been listening to the whole family of shows since the beginning and enjoy both your views and sensibilities. As an LCS employee and longtime collector, I find your shows a breath of fresh air in today's ever-growing landscape of comics. And here's the key part. As a way to pay it forward, I have a box of quarter bin comics that I would like to donate to you free of charge. Consider it for services rendered in all of the hours of enjoyment you've given me. I will also be sending a little something for Emily that may or may not have been mentioned in a show in the summer. Not giving any clues. In closing, all the best to both of you, and thank you for your hard work.
Now, I may have said this before on the show, but there's a great quote that I heard from a radio guy. But it totally applies to podcasting. And it's become my personal podcasting motto. You go into this line of work for three reasons. One, to help your friends. Two, to crush your enemies. And three, to get free stuff.
You know what I say? Two out of three ain't bad.
That one's for you, Michael Bailey. And Rob laid the gauntlet down. Now, he does have an advantage as an actual LCS employee of Comics Connection in Oakville, Ontario. But this is just a sampling of what he sent in. Some 1980s Marvel annuals, a lot of Black Hawk books, lots of legions from various eras.
Super excited about that.
Just a great variety of stuff. And the promised book for Emily,
a Babylon 5 trade paperback, which had my name written on it, all big, was all wrapped up in plastic, so my dad couldn't get his grubby little hands on it.
The yellow sticky on it just said Emily, but I interpreted that note from Rob as, Professor, don't you dare even touch it.
Don't look at it. Don't think about it.
And as more evidence of what a nice Canadian fellow Rob is, he is involved with the Comics Corps of Canada, comiccorps.ca, which is a group that does good works in hospitals, including visiting in costume and delivering comics to sick kids.
Aww! Here's the thing. Nerds taking up the mantle, going and being heroes. Ugh. Makes my little fan heart go pitter-patter.
Much respect, Rob. Much respect. Now, before we move on to the main topic of this episode, we did want to talk about some of the things we've been reading recently.
Yes. As everyone already knows from my probably last two, three episodes sort of pre-show discussion, as with many other people, I can say with complete certainty that Constantine has ruined me. I have been delving for fanfic until I ran out of it. I joined Facebook groups and Tumblr groups. I signed up for a mailing letter. I bought a t-shirt. Like, I have gone full blown into my Hellblazer fandom, which has seeped out into me having to read every book that John Constantine, see, I said it right, has ever appeared in. Look, Sandman.
You listened to one episode of Hey Kids Comics.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about this. And now you call him Constantine?
Well, I had to go and read some Sandman. I picked up Saga of the Swamp Thing. I guess you could say just had a really bad case of vertigo. I basically decided I would start at the beginning. I'd already read Volume 1 of Sandman. I'd mentioned that in a previous episode. I read Volume 2. I originally asked a friend for Volume 3, but then I was like, nope, gotta go check out Saga of the Swamp Thing and Hellblazer and all sorts of other stuff, so that's waiting for right now. I've now read the first three volumes of Saga of the Swamp Thing, and the first one, pretty good. The Anatomy Lesson.
A classic.
There's a reason it's classic. It's fantastic. Volume 3 just utterly emotionally destroyed me. Volume 2 was good, but very gross because it's just bugs. Just bugs everywhere for an entire volume. And I was like, oh God, why am I putting myself through this?
You know where Swamp Thing mostly takes place?
Yeah, swamp.
You know what there's a lot of in the swamp?
See, but most of the bugs are like actually kind of adorable.
Okay,
and it's like, he's like Treebeard and there's just like little things like, you know, in his chest. And there's just like little beetles and stuff, and it's like, oh, that's adorable. And then Abby's husband shows up, and I'm like, oh my God, you're made of flies. That was the worst. That was literally the worst. That was the only time thus far in my vertigo vortex travel through space and time that I've been going on that I have felt ill to my stomach. I know it's going to happen more, but that was the first one. Then Volume 3 was just a punch in my feelings. It was so good. And of course, Constantine!
Now, actually, a lot of my current reading, again, sort of coincidentally, has been Vertigo. And it's important to remember that, for me, when I say current reading,
oh yeah,
that does mean trade paperback collections that are anywhere from 1 to 2 years behind.
Dad,
to me, those are my current books.
Dad, my current reading is from 1982.
I understand. Understand. So, I did want to mention a few of the current Vertigo books I'm reading, and one is The Unwritten by Mike Carey and Peter Gross, and the pitch is this. What if J.K. Rowling had a son named Harold Potter? And in his mid-20s or so, after Rowling's death, it turned out that Potter was indeed a wizard, and the events of the books began coming true. Yeah, that's in essence what's going on in The Unwritten. And I am through about issue 45 or 46 or so, and thoroughly enjoy it. I also read an actual graphic novel from 2008, a book that has never been released as individual issues, and so it does actually qualify as a graphic novel, which both J. Dave and Kyle Benning, maybe even Trennis, have sort of ranted about recently, that term graphic novel, when it applies and when it doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
It's a collection of previously printed comic books.
It's not a graphic novel.
It's not a graphic novel. But people sometimes use that term sort of as a way of distancing themselves from comic books.
It's a comic book that's been to college.
Exactly.
Or that you can purchase in a college.
Hey, there you go. So this one actually is a graphic novel. And it's a historical graphic novel taking place in the South of the 1920s, 1930s. I don't think it's based on a specific true story, but more on specific events that did happen. And the book is called Incognegro, and it's about a light-skinned African-American journalist who passes as white to infiltrate Klan meetings, to report on lynchings for Northern newspapers. Really interesting stuff. And the concept of passing actually applies in a couple different ways in the book as well, that theme. As well as it just has a great conclusion. The last couple of pages sort of almost have a Twilight Zone-y sort of ending where just desserts are dealt out within the context of the story. Really interesting stuff.
I remember when you brought this book home, you did say, now I found a book. I think you're really going to like it. Now you just have to go with this. The title is Incognegro. And my immediate response was, oh, that's amazing. I need to read it. Because it's a pun. It's historically accurate. Sounds fascinating.
And evidently that is the term that was used for journalists and others to go incognegro. To pass it for the purpose of reporting on or, you know, taking names and numbers of mm-hmm. of people who were involved in lynchings and other illegal acts.
I'm really excited for this. This is on my Vertigo to read list, but of course, my to read list is
has gotten really,
huge.
Really long.
I've decided that, you know, I'm just gonna read basically every Vertigo book that was ever published, you know, starting from Saga of the Swamp Thing Volume 1 and going all the way up.
Have you done any Hellblazers yet?
Has not
that
yet.
Been on your list?
Okay. I'm holding off on Hellblazer. I'm sort of half going chronological-ish
right.
for Constantine appearances. Though, of course, I started with Sandman just because right. I was reading
well,
Sandman.
Have,
and then, oh,
to.
Hey, Constantine.
See, Constantine showed up there.
I didn't expect you to show up.
I don't think you've gotten into the late 40s. Of Saga of the Swamp Thing, certainly into episode 50,
no.
where Constantine is again a major character.
No, I think it's issue 40 is the first one in volume 4 that I have not yet started. I will say, I just skimmed through the first couple of pages, read the intro sort of, then decided I'm going to hold off on this until I can catch up on some of my other reading.
Right.
It does have my single favorite page in Saga of the Swamp Thing thus far, where on the one page you've got some guy drinking at a pub, and then Constantine shows up and is like, oh, you know, you've got this problem, well, come with me, we'll go get a drink, I'll take you here, there's some craziness going on. And then, oh, what's going on with the sky? Yeah, it's all red outside, and you turn the page and suddenly Batman. And it's just fantastic. And leads into my favorite thing thus far, Constantine in, like, the greater sense of Hellblazer and Saga of the Swamp Thing and TV show and New 52 and also Injustice is the fact that John Constantine and Batman are kind of epic bros. Like, I don't know why. It sort of weirdly makes sense to me that John's three besties are Chaz, his, you know, occasionally immortal cab driver, a sentient plant elemental and biochemist, and a billionaire playboy philanthropist who dresses like a bat. Like, that just makes sense.
It takes all kinds. To be fair, that would be an awesome poker game.
Oh, I know,
the
right?
Four of them would be epic.
I know, right? This
Constantine
guys?
Cheats, though.
Oh.
Psh, of course.
Obviously. This right here is exactly why fanfic exists. That right there.
For the poker match.
Oh, yes. I need to see if that exists. Anyway. Got to get back to Sandman at some point. Actually, Fables. Someone had asked me, have you read Fables? I was like, of course I've read Fables. And then I was like, Wait, I actually only ever read the first 3 or 4 volumes of Fables, and we have 10 of them at my library right now. So that might actually be my next thing.
That's another one where my being up to date means I'm about 3 years behind.
Yeah.
I think they're in the late 140s. It's going to end at 150. And I think I've read through about 110 or so.
And you've been reading Jack and
the other spinoffs. And I thoroughly enjoy, I think, again, what Bill Willingham has done there to create that entire world is very impressive.
Yeah. Incognigro, Fables, Hellblazer. I actually picked this up kind of on a lark, partially because it was highlighted on Comic Book DB is Punk Rock Jesus.
To be fair, it was highlighted on Comic Book DB on Easter.
Which
sort of
makes sense.
Kind of.
I was also having this discussion because getting into Hellblazer, becoming a fan of John Constantine in general, means I've kind of reverted to my punk teenage years that I never really had because I was too busy being, you know, mature and responsible.
She actually was.
So I've been delving into Against Me and the Sex Pistols and the Clash, and it's been fun. And you know, this concept of punk rock Jesus, it actually kind of works. There is a not insignificant overlap between the story of the Gospels and any iconoclastic movement that wants to take down the establishment. So I have my fingers crossed. It looks, at the very least, interesting.
Further reports to come.
Yes.
I'm actually not sure which came first, our decision to talk about antiheroes and our delving into Vertigo, old and new, but there is quite an overlap.
Yeah, it's been a really fortunate confluence of events.
So we're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we will talk about the concept of the antihero in comic books. And we'll do that right after this.
Hey kids, do you like comics?
Uh-huh.
Do you like Iron Man comics?
Uh-huh.
Do you want to learn more about Iron Man's downward spiral from alcoholism, fear of commitment, and feelings of inferiority, leading the egomaniac into a life of misery?
What?
Then listen to the Invincible Ironcast Classics Edition and see Tony Stark go from genius, billionaire, playboy, philanthropist to genius, billionaire, playboy, philanthropist with awesome weaponized armor. Relive classic stories like Demon in a Bottle, Armor Wars, Doom Quest, and more, hosted by me, Mike Staley. So how about it, kids? Do you want to listen to the Invincible Ironcast?
Uh-huh.
Well, too bad. You need to do your homework.
Uh-huh.
The Invincible Ironcast Classics Edition, on iTunes or at invincibleironcast.podbean.com.
And we're back.
And now we come to Emily's favorite part of every episode. Define your terms.
Yes. I'm not saying I'm an academician, but I totally have to define my terms in my episodes and give citations for all of my works used. So, yeah.
Kind of makes you feel sorry for my wife, doesn't it? Married to an academic and raising one. Ugh.
Just nerds everywhere.
Poor girl.
So, before we talk about what an anti-hero is, let's talk about what a hero is. Now, your traditional, and I mean like classical literature, pre-Rome, Grecian play type of classical, definition for a hero is whoever is the main character. And today, we would simply call that the protagonist. And a protagonist does not actually have to have any sort of moral high ground or authority. It's just who the plot revolves around. And this gives us things like our villain protagonist, which is actually one of my favorite kinds of stories. If only because you aren't automatically rooting for the person because they are terrible in some way. And the writer then has to convince you somehow to sympathize with, or at very least understand. It's an interesting writing challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we would generally call a hero, specifically in a comic book sort of sense, of a superhero, would be a person of distinguished courage or ability in the face of adversity, admired for his brave deeds and noble character.
Yeah, I would say hero originally was simply a noun.
Right.
Which is to say it was the person that the story is about. But now hero or heroic tends to have this adjective sense to it, applying positive characteristics to that term.
Right, and it can be anything. A firefighter who ran back into a building to save a pregnant woman. He is a hero. Not because he has mythical ancestry or superhuman powers, but just because he was a very good person and did a brave thing, even though it was difficult.
Right.
Now, when we talk about anti-heroes, a lot of the examples that I could think of were modern. 1970s on modern.
Right.
And we came up with a few that were sort of classical literary characters, but they just didn't have that same feeling that you would associate with the word anti-hero today. So I was interested to see where the word actually first came from. And the first reference that I could find in my Google fooing for a definition was in 1714. And in this context, where the hero may be dashing, strong, brave, resourceful, and handsome, the anti-hero would be incompetent, unlucky, clumsy, dumb, clownish, or ugly.
But still be the main character.
Exactly.
So it'd be the protagonist, but not have traditional heroic qualities.
Right. And in this case, not necessarily moral characteristics, but just what you would expect from your Hollywood hero.
Right. Gotcha.
Strong, hunky. The most classic example of this is one of your favorite characters, Don Quixote.
Ah!
That he is the hero of the story, even though he's old, mentally ill, really has no idea what's going on, fails constantly. He does not complete the heroic cycle.
Right. Interesting thing about Don Quixote and Cervantes is it is considered the first modern novel. It's also considered the first postmodern novel. Because the second half of it, or part two of it, is partially about the response to him as presented in the first part of the novel. So there is almost a meta-narrative happening. So it's modern, it's postmodern, and it's anti-hero all at once.
Yep.
That's quite an accomplishment, Cervantes.
It really is.
And is a pretty good musical.
So I've heard.
So there.
And partially because I've actually been listening to a couple episodes of Hey Kids Comics. You know, it only seems right since we totally ripped them off. They've been doing a little mini podcast series about Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is actually shockingly similar to Don Quixote. That, in my opinion, Scott Pilgrim is this sort of classical anti-hero. He is an absolute idiot. He's adorable, but not traditionally attractive. He is really terrible to a lot of his friends. Even though he wins, a lot of times it's not through his own capability. It's just sheer dumb luck or someone else coming and saving his Canadian bacon.
And he is generally incompetent at life skills.
Absolutely. Absolutely useless. You just, Ramona Flowers. Hey, can you unload the dishwasher? Sure. Plays video games for 6 hours. Did you unload the dishwasher? What? When did you get back? Like, Scott Pilgrim. Bad at life. Even in his own book. Right. Especially in his own book.
So he hits this sort of classic anti-hero,
mm-hmm.
being the hero, the main character, but not possessing traditional competence and attractiveness and skills and abilities.
But that doesn't encapsulate this sort of grim and gritty Punisher type of anti-hero that tends to spring to mind when we're talking about anti-heroes in comics. But I could still find some pretty early references to this, from 1850, in reference to the Byronic hero. In this case, the anti-hero is a romanticized but wicked character who defies authority and becomes paradoxically ennobled by his peculiar rejection of virtue.
So now we're getting into the more modern meaning of anti-hero, which really didn't get picked up for 150 plus years, I think.
Really? it was Byron, and then not terribly many examples, and then people you want to talk about, Sam Spade, and following him, Dirty Harry, and John Constantine.
Yeah, that's about the progress. Because about the earliest one that I could think of, you mentioned, was sort of the noir detective from 1930s. Sam Spade, like you said. And because to me, the concept of the antihero is a very modern concept, like in the 1970s and onward, I would place it. But like you, I think we suspected that it was older somehow, just far fewer examples.
Right.
So I came up with that hard-boiled detective, but I did wonder about more sort of mainstream literature. So I did check in with Tom Panarese.
Noted expert on the English language.
Professional high school literature teacher. And his response reflects part of the definitional issue, because he kept thinking of someone like Victor Frankenstein, who then he would dismiss as, what's more a tragic hero than an anti-hero? So again, part of it is a question of, as you said, define the terms. He did mention McMurtry from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or Meursault from Camus' The Stranger, and on some level, Raskolnikov from Crime and Punishment. As I said, he teaches
high school literature,
so those were, of course, his examples. But I do think we've certainly seen an explosion of antiheroes, not just in comics, but in pop culture, from really the 1970s on, and I think probably Dirty Harry is probably the first, maybe modern, mainstream antihero. Maybe some of the Western characters, maybe some of the Clint Eastwood, Man with No Name, maybe those would qualify from the 60s, but I think it's in that era.
Yeah, a lot of them you can look at and, you know, squint sideways at a little and go, maybe. Because we were even trying to come up with things like Zorro. Well, does Zorro count as an antihero? And I would say no, for the same reason that Batman does not count as an antihero.
Now, well, before we get into comic books, I also mentioned Robin Hood, really going way back.
Yep, same thing.
But no, not really. It is more of a hero. Now, again, sort of violating law, but not to the same extent.
And there, it's more a thing of literary irony. That he is a thief and a poacher. You would think that would then mean he was morally bankrupt.
Right.
But he is, ironically, the most moral person there who is fighting for not just the greater good, but actually the, you know, direct good. The rightful king and feeding the poor and actually very strong moral Christian values.
Right.
That he is not anti-establishment, but he wants the establishment, he wants the proper establishment in charge, the people that are supposed to be in charge, the proper king, and, you know, lawful members of the church. He doesn't want to tear those structures down.
Right.
He wants to uphold them. Same thing with Batman.
Right.
If you don't mind me transitioning at this point into comics, because a lot of times when we think about, you know, there's the Punisher. You know, that is sort of what we think of as the ultimate antihero.
Probably in comic books, the classic, almost stereotypical antihero would be the Punisher.
Right. And it's like, well, but is there someone more mainstream than that? And a lot of people come to Batman. But Batman really isn't. In a lot of ways, he is the representation of the establishment.
What happens in the very first panel of the very first Batman issue, Detective Comics 27, who is Bruce Wayne's best friend?
Commissioner Gordon. He doesn't want to destroy the police. He wants to help the police. He works specifically with the police. He's a billionaire. He is the 1%. He is a member of the establishment. He is Robin Hood. In a lot of the Robin Hood cases, again, slightly depending on who's translating and who's reinterpreting, Robin Hood's a noble. He's not just some guy who gets swept up in this and becomes the figurehead of this revolution. He's a rich guy who's had his wealth stolen and wants it back. He is Batman. That he's using his political knowledge and his money and his intrigue and all that sort of thing in order to fix the system.
Now, if we think Golden Age, and I'm thinking, you know, Michael Bradley and John Wilson, who have really covered this area on podcasts, to some extent, in the first few years, the late 1930s, Superman was more anti-hero than Batman was.
Absolutely. And which is why it's, you know, sort of ironic that they've become representations of the establishment for Superman and of sort of vigilante pseudo-anarchy for Batman. Whereas it's almost the exact opposite when you look at their origins. That in Superman's case, he is the orphan. He's raised by farmers. He's poor. And he rises up above that to challenge the structures of his society. That he calls out anyone.
Political corruption. There's a lot of what was going on in those early issues, as well as business corruption.
Mm-hmm. And mob involvement and things like that. But he'll go after anyone. Because he doesn't have to worry about being hurt, he can cut through the mob.
Right.
You know, enforcers try to shoot him. He's like, psh, that's not going to stop me. I'm going to take this, you know, this corrupt politician. I'm going to dangle him off of a building in a very Batman fashion until he confesses.
Because the best confession is the forced confession.
I'll just blatantly destroy public property and private property. I'll just, this evil businessman is drilling illegally on native land. I'm just going to rip the entire oil drilling platform out of the ground and burn it. And just throw it into the sun.
Early Superman's answer to, you know, slumlords, tear down the buildings. Just flat out knock down the buildings.
Yeah. No respect for private property. No respect for proper procedure. No desire to get evidence. Just immediate, firm, really violent justice.
Not quite to the level of Golden Age Spectre, but close.
But close. Close.
So we said sort of the modern anti-hero movement in pop culture in general. We mentioned movies. I do think maybe some of those Westerns, but certainly by the time we get to Dirty Harry, I think we're legitimately at anti-hero.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to the Punisher as really the first mainstream example of this.
Right.
And I think part of the issues with the anti-hero is that they have heroic tendencies and heroic goals.
Right. And this is an important question. I, of course, address these sorts of things in my head from a D&D character alignment sort of place. Right. Of, are they chaotic neutral, lawful good, chaotic good, lawful evil? Things of that nature, of how do they interact with society, how do they interact with morality. To simplify things, we put it on a spectrum of going from hero to villain. That you have your straight-up bread-and-butter heroes. Then next to them, in the shades of gray area, is the anti-hero, who has less respect for law and order, but still a very strong respect for justice. Then you have the sympathetic villain, who will have understandable motivation or maybe an engaging personality, but still do really terrible things, mostly for their own ends. And then your straight-up, mustache-twirling, absolute pants-on-head evil villain.
And I think, you know, where you have hero and villain being very far from each other on the spectrum, black and the white ends of the spectrum, in the sort of middle of the spectrum, anti-hero and sympathetic villain are actually much closer to each other. And we can say there are a number of characters that sort of bounce back and forth between those two. And I'm thinking especially in Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I've talked about Doom before. And obviously, as a loyal acolyte to the rightful ruler of Latveria.
Yes.
I have been enthused whenever he's portrayed not, you know, just as a villain. That portrayal, to me, is simplistic and sort of misses the point of Doom. Now, there are two exceptions to that. Times when Doom as villain really worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the two Doom episodes of the animated Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon.
Oh, that was
those
great.
Those are hilarious.
Because,
especially the one with Captain America and
Phil
Coulson and the shield and the embassy.
They have to go get the shield back from Old Man Doom's lawn.
That was pretty funny.
That's great.
But with that exception, in there, Doom is pure villainy and hilarious.
Right.
But I think that Kirby and Lee really got it right in Doom's origin in FF Annual 2, where he is much closer to being an anti-hero. And I like that nature of Doom. And I think when his stories tilt more in that direction, I really appreciate it. You know, Doom 2099 being a classic case of a storyline, a title that put Doom somewhere in the anti-hero to hero category. Yeah. And I think just in general, a lot of the examples we can come up with of this are Marvel, because they've been doing the shades of gray
for a
lot longer.
In my mind, especially early Marvel was so good at having sympathetic villains that they could really swing anywhere on the spectrum. Namor is a great example because he has been all four of these.
Yeah, he has been a legitimate hero.
He punched Nazis. I mean, to be fair, everyone punched Nazis.
And they did deserve it.
Yeah.
But he's been the flat-out villain. He's been the sympathetic villain. He's been the anti-hero.
He's done it all.
You know, so again, on Namor, you know, I wanted to talk to a fan. So I talked to Kurt Green, and he basically agreed that most often Namor probably fits anti-hero the best. But again, he did point out in some instances he is a flat-out hero. Obviously the Defender stories we've talked about, as well as when John Byrne wrote the character in the title Namor in the 80s or 90s. And similarly, we have a friend who is a big fan of Deadpool, who also sort of skirts the lines as to which of these categories he fits into.
Right. This would be our friend Lauren Boisseau from activelynerdy.blogspot.com. And I reached out to her for an official opinion, since she had just done a blog post about an unknown, or certainly underknown, character from the Deadpool run. She'd been blasting through that, so as someone who'd read a ton of Deadpool recently, I asked her which one he fit into. And she, like Kirk, said, absolutely anti-hero. In Deadpool's case, he is just far too rough, violent, morally, in some senses, bankrupt to ever be considered a hero. But he does have a streak in him that can be good, and he has the capability to be heroic at times. But his methods are always terrible.
I think that might be one of the really powerful aspects of the anti-hero, is that you're only one step away from hero. You're also one step away from sympathetic villain.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can really operate in those shades of gray, where different creators can write him different ways, different readers can interpret it different ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the appealing aspects for creators.
Right.
To take on this type of character. And to me, sort of the classic case is in Watchmen.
Right.
The character of Rorschach, who, of course, to Alan Moore, by all reports, he wrote him as a villain.
Mm-hmm. And a straw man.
Wanted him to be a villain. That's right. So over-exaggerated him to the extent that it would be clear that no one would think this person was good in any way. But of course, if you ask people who the most, certainly most memorable character in Watchmen is.
Or even the most sympathetic.
Even
weirdly,
the most sympathetic or likable, Rorschach pops up pretty high on that list. So I think almost unintentionally, Moore wrote a terrific anti-hero.
This is the thing about Alan Moore, is that he is all about the deconstruction and finding the anti-whatever. And in a way, he wrote the anti-anti-hero in an attempt to make him a straight-up villain and made him a hero. Like the double negatives he became so passionate and so focused that even if you didn't agree with what he was doing, and certainly not the way he was doing it, you still had to admire him. It was that summary from that definition I read earlier, which I just loved. The character that is paradoxically ennobled by his lack of virtue. Because it's this idea that if you strip away all of your social expectations, all the way down to your sense of morality, in Rorschach's case for sure, that what you're left with at that little core is so clear that even if it's wrong, it's sort of impressive.
Yeah, I think, you know, in a world where shades of gray are the norm, both in our world and in the world of comic books, the world of the Watchmen in particular, when someone has an unwavering commitment to a cause, the cause really being justice. Again, methods, questionable.
Yes.
But an unwavering commitment, that stands out. And I think that's what makes Rorschach not blend in to the rest of the characters. He is a distinct voice. Moore certainly wrote him with a distinct voice. He did not intend that distinct voice to be sympathetic or positive. But because it's so different, because that unwavering commitment to a set of principles, he certainly stands out.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about really what does make an anti-hero. Mm-hmm. Because I was really wavering a lot on whether or not we could count Deadpool. And this is why we reached out to Lauren. And also part of why we chose the title The Rorschach Test. Because you can look at these characters and what you see really does reveal a lot about the way you see the world.
Right.
If you consider Namor a hero, anti-hero, or villain, says a lot about what you consider a hero, anti-hero, and a villain to be.
Your own priorities, your own...
In my admittedly much less exposure to Deadpool, really feel him more as a sympathetic villain. Just because, in my mind, he's so unfocused. And this is why Rorschach really is the absolute anti-hero. Because I think it is necessary for an anti-hero not to have morals. Usually not to have morals. But they must have a code.
Right.
And Deadpool certainly has one. His code is very lax. Intentionally. Because he's insane. So the rules don't really apply to him. Which is why I don't think he really quite counts. He certainly does in a sort of popular sense of what you would call him. He fits anti-hero the best. But... I mean, it's almost... Deadpool is simply Deadpool. There is no plotting him on the chart.
His own category.
Yeah.
But I think, so going back to your D&D, I think one of the differences between Rorschach and Deadpool would be the word chaotic.
Yes.
Deadpool is chaotic. Rorschach is methodical.
Yeah.
The exact opposite of chaotic.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the difference, sort of the unpredictability.
I mean, the thing that's so great about the concept of an antihero is it's a really broad category. It's anyone who is neither entirely good nor entirely evil. That's most of humanity.
Right, right.
But the sort of the check marks on your antihero mm-hmm. checklist, I also came up with where a villain has a might makes right philosophy. That because I have the strength to do this, it's okay for me to do this. An anti-hero lives by the motto, whatever is necessary. Not because I can do it, I should. But if I have to, I will not flinch.
Right.
That perfect example, Feast of Friends. I don't want to kill my best friend. I'd really rather not. I certainly don't want to emotionally torture him by giving him hope. But that is what I have to do. That is what I will do. Because the alternative is worse. Also, a lack of regard for the system. Be this police, government, other superheroes, or simply societal and moral norms. Yeah.
Politics, and any authority, any establishment. Right.
Absolutely. And this is that whole thing about the paradoxically ennobled. That if you're someone like John Constantine, and you don't blink in the face of murder... You can recognize that sometimes that is necessary. You can make those choices that other people can't. And that gives you a freedom, but also, weirdly, a moral responsibility.
Right.
That you are the only one who can do this. I'm thinking of one example in particular from Justice League Dark. Which, the first volume of Justice League Dark, not that great. The second volume I like a lot better. And I've started reading the third, and it looks pretty interesting. But in the first volume, they are fighting the Enchantress. And they realize at one point that the Enchantress has been split into two personalities. And that essentially her good personality that was keeping her crazy in check was separated. And everyone else on the team spends their entire time, especially Deadman, Boston Brand, spend all of their time in that volume trying to figure out how to save this girl, this alternate personality. The only person who recognizes what is necessary, which is to refuse the Enchantress, to kill this girl, to erase her existence, is John Constantine. and he waits for everyone else to be gone, finds her, and begins refusing her with the Enchantress. Only for Boston to show up and punch him in the face, to which he replies, "Oh great, just what I didn't need, a bloody hero."
Because Constantine is not that, but he gets the job done.
And he that's the key, is he recognizes what is necessary. There is no way to save this girl. And because he doesn't have the same moral strictures that everybody else does, he can consider every opportunity. What happens if we kill the Enchantress? Well, then this girl's probably going to go insane because half of her is dead. What if we kill her? Well, then the Enchantress is still screwed. What if we just let them be? The entire planet will burn. All of these are unacceptable. The only option which is acceptable is sending this girl back to living hell. And he's willing to do it. Because that's what gets the job done. There's a power in that, but there's also a weird sort of its own morality and a sense of escapism. That there is somebody, somewhere, who can cut through the red tape and do what needs to be done. You know, we all have our moments where we wish, oh, if only I could just tell my boss exactly what I think of him. Oh, if only I could just go and we could impeach this politician and everything would be better. Or if this person just left. Or if this company was bankrupt. All of a sudden, everything would be better if you could just do this action. And antiheroes give us that. That ability to just kill that person, imprison that person, force them out, threaten them, get rid of the stuff that's in the way of the wheels of justice and society turning properly.
I think that's, to me, what you're saying speaks to the rise of popularity of antiheroes recently, because there is something interesting to me about the antihero and thinking about this, and it cuts across demographics or socio-political differences. Because an antihero is about taking on failed institutions. And however you view the world, wherever on a political or social spectrum you are, there are plenty of institutions that you think are failing. And we can get to broad agreement that big business is a problem, or that the education system is a mess, or that police can't always be trusted like we'd like, or religious institutions can sometimes be money grubbers. That even an elite, well-thought-of federal body like the Secret Service turns out to be utterly mismanaged, we've learned recently. But when we get to proposing solutions in the real world,
that's where it breaks down.
We start to divide quickly. Do we need more money for schools? Or are teacher unions that prioritize job security the bigger problem? Do we need to tax big business confiscatory levels to redistribute wealth? Or do we need to let capitalism work with fewer restrictions? Do we need to outlaw private gun ownership to keep us safe? Or is the right to that form of self-defense fundamental? So, you know, when we get to proposing specific answers, we get fights and divisions and ugly Facebook posts.
Mm-hmm.
But we can all share, like you were saying, the fantasy of the antihero. Just stepping in outside the limits of political discourse or government strictures or economic strictures to just fix the problem. That we can all get behind. So I think there is almost this fantasiacal element to it, this daydream element to it.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we all know that it is absolutely a fantasy, because if it's not one thing, it's something else. Just the idea that somewhere in some fictional parallel universe, we could just fix X.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a better world.
Right. And I think that's what makes this sort of concept of the antihero appealing. A quest for justice in a world gone mad. A quest for simple solution to complex problems. And in the late 1930s, the simple solution was hanging the bad guy by his ankles from the top of the 10th story to get him to confess. And it's a little more complex now, whether it's going in, and as Mark Adams would say, I go in and I kill the drug dealers.
I don't even know what that is.
Or whether it's Rorschach's approach in the Watchmen world.
There are plenty of people who take these ideas. I mean, Anonymous, modeling itself after V, and taking that mask, that idea of if the people will simply spread information, information will fix things. Well, we've seen a lot of times it only makes things more complicated. Same thing, Edward Snowden, just get the information out there and there will be accountability. Well, not yet. Or some charitable organization, throw money at it and it will go away. Or throw money at it, it'll get better. Not always.
Let's raise billions of dollars and send it to Haiti.
Yeah.
That'll fix the
problem. That's going to be a great idea. But I think in the end, the biggest thing that antiheroes give us is not entirely escapism. Because let me just say,
right,
reading just the brief bits of Hellblazer that I've done, spending more than 10 minutes on the Hellblazer Wikipedia page is not a pleasant experience. It is not an escapist reality.
The world of Watchmen is not paradise to live in. Even Alan Moore's Swamp Thing is not, a lot of these. Or I think about 1980s television. This one's for you, Andy Leyland. The Equalizer, a terrific antihero that if you're in a world that needs an antihero, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, the antihero worked in the 70s and 80s, it worked in grimy, dirty New York City.
Right. When you had
Robert McCall, because that place was an ungovernable mess.
In the era of post-Vietnam and rise of drugs.
Watergate and all of those.
And
things,
nothing.
Questioning
you
of
can't
institutions.
Trust anyone.
Right.
It used to be the police was your friend. The police is not your friend. You should be suspicious. You can't trust the government. You can't trust anyone. Mm-hmm. But the real feeling of, in my opinion, of what an antihero gives us is not escape, but catharsis. That we go through this really painful process and really terrible stories with these characters in order to get that sense of relief at the end.
Right.
And to really go through this for a sense of hope. That right now, in the real world, we're living in the first 25 minutes of the Equalizer episode, where everyone is dying and there's drugs everywhere and crazy men are chasing you down alleys with a switchblade and getting stalked on train stations. The world is terrible, but if we can just get through it, if we can push past it, there is this paradoxical sense of hope.
Right.
That it's so terrible now, it has to get better.
Or it can be set to rights. Mm-hmm. There is a way for that to happen.
Yes.
That happy ending is out there. It can happen.
Yeah. And the happy endings, you know, we say happy endings.
Yes.
The adequate ending, the better ending. It's not right. Things can get perfect. You know, you do not get Hollywood endings in a lot of these anti-hero stories. Right. You get the world didn't end. We can make it another day. Life goes on.
Right. I like this idea of catharsis and relief as being from consumers' perspectives, from a reader's perspective, a reviewer's perspective, really what you get out of the anti-hero story.
Yeah. It's something everyone can relate to, is that sense of relief, that sense of hope. Life carries on. No matter how terrible it is, life carries on.
There is hope. We are certain that we have just barely scratched the surface of this topic.
And as we've said repeatedly, everyone has an opinion on
exactly.
Antiheroes. Everyone relates to them.
So we're very interested in what you find listeners have to say about the topic. And there are many ways to reach us with that feedback.
You can email us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. Or check out our blog where you can leave a comment on this episode at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can also check out our Facebook page, which we have. Like that and comment, talk to your fellow listeners and see what ideas you can all bring up together.
And as we said at the beginning of the episode, if you would like to leave a rating or a review in iTunes, we would appreciate that as well. And always keep in mind, in regards to this topic and every topic, we're not experts.
We're just family.
Thanks for listening.
Bye, guys.
Listen to your parents, but don't trust the government. Don't trust the government. Don't trust the government. Listen to your parents, but don't trust the government. That's just a good idea.
Everybody,
Listen to your parents, but don't trust the government. Don't trust the government. Don't trust the government. Listen to your parents, but don't trust the government. That's just a good idea. That's just a good idea.